and abuses of power in this country. Her program relates the news of the week to emerging evidence about the conspiracy which allegedly maintains by force its control over the legislative, executive, and judicial processes in America. And now, Mae Brussel.
Good afternoon. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. It's March 28th, 1977. And this is Dialogue Conspiracy number 262. Last week on Dialogue Conspiracy, I did quite a lengthy rundown on the chronology of James Earl Ray, and I received a lot of calls and letters on that. People enjoyed hearing the background of James Earl Ray, his travels, the amount of money he spent. And I'm going to continue to do more on him within the next two or three weeks. That was just a sample in a short period of time of the way that James Earl Ray moved around. I want to wait till the article comes out on the West Coast. It's in New Times now on James Earl Ray, and discuss it with you because it's a very controversial article, and it's as confusing to the researchers, or will be, as the committee in Washington infight that's going on that was between Representative Henry Gonzalez and Richard Sprigg, the prosecutor back there. The article in New Times is written by David Lifton and Jeff Cohn. David Lifton has been a longtime researcher on the Kennedy assassination, and he's an engineering student. He's getting on in years now, but he was studying engineering at UCLA, and he was the person who provided me with many of my documents for the National Archives on the Kennedy assassination. And David Lifton also published a book, a document, addendum to the Warren Commission, and he has the minutes of the Warren Commission meeting, some of the very valuable minutes of the meetings. Lifton has been very particular about his research, or pinpointing what he was doing in terms of the motorcade for years. He's been meticulous on the John Kennedy assassination. Then all of a sudden, he came out with an article that is totally false in the New Times magazine, and it's really surprising that somebody as particular and meticulous as David Lifton would bring out this article. The claims of the New Times article by Jeff Cohn and David Lifton is that James Earl Ray and his brother Jerry Ray were responsible for the killing of Martin Luther King, and that the mysterious Rowell that was meeting James Earl Ray was none other than his brother. New Times is known to the very serious researchers as a magazine that appears to be left, but it's a slick cover-up of a cover-up, and there are various people there, such as Robert Sam Anson, that's on the staff. He's on the staff, who I do not trust, and I did not like his book, They Killed the President. Anson is one of the publishers or executives there defending the article. The article is a very simplistic one, and I know that David Lifton knows better than to put his name to any article as slipshod as this. It's based upon old FBI reports and another author, William Bradford Huey, who was part of the first cover-up of the Martin Luther King assassination. I've known David Lifton for many years, since about 1964. I know his work in the Kennedy matter, and I can't believe that he seriously would sign his name to this article. This must just be the second or third printed article he's ever done, because it's a terrible article. And opposing that article is Mark Lane, the researcher and author who's suing New Times about it. And Mark Lane is representing Jerry Ray. That's James Earl Ray's brother. And this makes an interesting lineup, because David Lifton and Mark Lane should be on the same side, and Jeff Cohn, who I do not consider a researcher, simply a mouthpiece, co-authored this particular article. And a year ago, he didn't believe there was a conspiracy to kill Martin Luther King at all. So they've co-authored this article, and I will go into it some more at length within a week or two as I read all the details of it. History is being perverted by people who appear as researchers, as well as the major news media, people like Dan Rather and the Cronkites, but it's really confusing for those who are very serious into studying the various assassinations to have to take sides with various researchers on a personality basis. I know when Jim Garrison, the district attorney from New Orleans, arrested Clay Shaw in New Orleans for being part of a conspiracy to kill John Kennedy, I went immediately to New Orleans as soon as I could to see his evidence and to meet Jim Garrison and see what he had. And it was at that point in 1967 that David Lifton got very angry with me and thought it was highly irresponsible to see Jim Garrison, that he had nothing to offer. And Lifton was very divisive among the researchers, as was Sylvia Marr in New York. She was considered the expert So far, the research is up till 67, and many still consider her one of the fine researchers. But she got involved in this Jim Garrison matter and wouldn't go to New Orleans to see him. In her book, Accessories After the Fact, is a very good book on the Kennedy assassination, and Sylvia did an index of the 26 volumes of the Warren Commission hearings, which is used by the researchers, which is an excellent index, except that in the testimony of the Kennedy assassination, when the name of Howard Hughes is brought up, such as the case of Jean de Morenschild, and I'll bring that up in a few minutes, or the Nazis that came from Germany, or the American Nazis that were trained in Germany, that moved to the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and there were those kind of Nazis. On 60 Minutes, about a month ago, Dan Rather had a subject on American Nazis and had pictures of some at Fort Ord, who I know trained there and exist as they do all over the country. Well, American Nazis were brought home from Germany, the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and German Nazis had direct links to people involved in the Kennedy assassination. And it seems that Sylvia Marr's index leaves out all the names of those particular witnesses. And David Lifton has never handled this angle of the assassination. He hasn't published much, but now he is helping with the cover-up or confusion of the Martin Luther King case. There are certain truths about these stories. I believe there are, and to get through all the infighting of the various researchers, you only have to list a certain amount of physical evidence that is important to solve any conspiracy or assassination. The killing of a president or a civil rights leader isn't any different than killing a person who runs a drugstore down the street or somebody that is a simple homicide. There's nothing more complicated in one case than the other. There's always the proof of weapon ownership, if a weapon was used, the absolute proof that the person charged even owned the weapon. You can examine the weapon capability, whether the scope works, whether it can shoot so many shots in a given amount of time, whether it contains fingerprints of the alleged assassin if he isn't wearing gloves. Is the ballistic account consistent with the weapon? If it can only shoot 8 bullets and the police department and the FBI have 11, could that weapon be the only one? You can draw out from witnesses and photographs the location of the alleged assassin. You can find the location of the alleged other killer if you compare it to autopsy reports in clothing and a fiber of fabrics to tell the direction of the bullets. You can check into the finances of these accused assassins to see where their money was coming from and what periods of time they could have access to people who funded them. There's lab work on photographic evidence if pictures are cropped at the chin, such as with Lee Harvey Oswald. And there are autopsy reports, burns, the head, the body, the amount of holes in the body, in addition to the fiber reports on clothing, the direction of bullets. All of these things are important, and they are the things that solve the crimes. When I study the assassination of John Kennedy or Robert Kennedy or Martin Luther King or the shooting of George Wallace or the shooting of Malcolm X or any of these murders, it's safest to stay just with the hard evidence. And then ask yourself, who is not using this evidence? Who is suppressing it? Who is discrediting the researchers who want to use the evidence? Is handwriting experts? There's lots of ways to solve a crime. And you have to get away from the infighting, which is taking place. Say, New Times is useful to promote the infighting. They write an article which isn't true. New Times wrote an article with Emily William Harris on the cover, which also was an untruth, and they have many articles that just slipshod over the actual evidence of the case, or they're only carrying a certain part of it, such as the Evening News does, they carry certain parts of it. So you have to read these articles and compare them, but it's important to know that there are many levels of hoaxes taking place to affect our minds, the way we see the world, the way our social structure is made, the way the economy goes. There are a lot of ways to change us, and the most drastic way is through various murders and assassinations, and it's important to study them. There's a new book out called The Voices of Guns. It's a story on the SLA by Paul Avery and a man named Mr. McClellan, Vin McClellan, and it's being advertised in the paper. Yesterday it was in the Chronicle. The Voices of Guns is to the SLA her story what Helter Skelter was to the Manson case. Well, that's probably the most true part of the entire book, because both books are fabrications of leaving out the whole truth, and both books are cover-ups of what are large plots, and the same way these various magazine articles continue the cover-up and to falsify. You have to study them if you're researching, and I will go into more on James Earl Ray in the near future, probably in a few weeks, and talk about that article. I did want to say that the Howard Hughes fingerprints did not show up on the envelope that was delivered in Las Vegas, Nevada. There's a lot of talk about a contractor by the name of Levain Forsythe leaving an envelope at the gas station where Mr. Dunbar was supposed to receive a will which left him $135 million. That envelope has been examined and doesn't have any fingerprints of Howard Hughes on it, but certain forces still want to make that the original will, the Mormon will. Reports of the Hughes estate and the lack of fingerprints and developments are only coming out of the Houston Post. A friend sends them to me. They're not on the Associated Press or the wire services, and I think it's important that people know what's going on in this country, but of course we're cut off from this information. Another way we're cut off is stories coming out of important trials. There is a lawsuit, a large lawsuit, $450 million lawsuit against the Summa Corporation, the Howard Hughes people, for the manipulation of Air West, the stock fraud. The Air West purchase when Howard Hughes bought it, dropping the stock down, and the stockholders were caught losing a lot of money. And this trial was about to take place a few weeks ago, March the 12th, 1977, in the U.S. District Court of Judge Bruce Thompson in Las Vegas, Nevada. The primary witness of this trial, the first and most important, is George Crockett. And sitting in the courtroom waiting to be tried were three very, very important men of our era. I think they're terribly important to many of the hoaxes and assassination teams that have gone on, particularly two of them. One is Robert Mayhew, the other is Chester Davis, the attorney, and the other is David Charney. Robert Mayhew hired men from organized crime to take part in assassination conspiracies. We know about the one against Fidel Castro, or the 30 times to kill Fidel Castro that didn't work, but Robert Mayhew should be questioned before the committee on the Robert Kennedy and the Martin Luther King and the John Kennedy assassination. Well, these men are assembled, and that's a lot of power in one courtroom. Robert Mayhew, Chester Davis, and David Charney are defendants in this particular case, and just when the trial was to take place in Las Vegas, Nevada, the chief witness disappeared. I don't know if he showed up yet. This is a UPI wire service story. It appeared only March the 12th, 1977, and only in the Las Vegas Sun. So if you don't take the Houston Post and you don't take the Las Vegas Sun, you wouldn't know that the primary witness in the stock of Air West is missing and has been missing since March the 12th. The body of Mr. Bramlett, Sam Bramlett, the labor leader, was finally found in Las Vegas. He disappeared February 24th, 1977. He's only one of a long list of labor leaders that have been killed in America. One was Mr. Yablonsky and his family. There was Saul Alinsky, Walter Reuther, and Jimmy Hoffa. Now this body has been found. There's been no prosecutions on the case. There's a man who has told the police department he was present when Sam Bramlett was murdered. But according to the Las Vegas Sun, nobody's been charged, and it's very possible that nobody will be charged, and they'll drag their feet on that. But it's interesting that just a year before Sam Bramlett's murder, there was an article in the Las Vegas Sun, the same paper, February the 4th, 1976, and this is the direct quote, "Billionaire Howard Hughes vowed to kill the Las Vegas Culinary Union during the 1970 strip strike," that's the Las Vegas Strip, "even if he had to close down the town for 1 year." This was published, a testimony of Mr. Greenspun, the publisher, and he testified under federal court Thursday, this is in February 1976, that the Hughes people would close the strip if they had to close the union, and vowed to kill the culinary union. So with that kind of strong language told by Mr. Greenspun in the federal court in 1976 in February, it's interesting that 1 year later, which was the date they gave, that Mr. Sam Bramlett was gone, dead, and that ends the problems, probably, of the Las Vegas Strip of the Culinary Union. It'll be interesting to see if the next union chief continues the work that Mr. Bramlett did, or whether They bow down to the pressures of people like the Summa Corporation. Another murder that I didn't talk about last week was the one in the Congo. The leader that was shot down, this is March 76, Marion Ngouabi. I hope I pronounced that right. He was described as a leftist, a left-leaning president of the People's Republic of the Congo. If you read the reports very carefully of what was going on in the Congo, you can compare him to Andreas Papandreou. He was in for land reforms. He was very left. He was a very intelligent person, a high leader of the ilk, say, of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, or Martin Luther King. He was a man who was making changes on land reform, and he was murdered. The Congo, a country where he was killed, borders along Zaire, and it's that country in Zaire that the United States is ready to go to war with because they need the copper. There's a long border there with Angola on the south and the Congo on the west of Zaire, and the multinational corporations have just come right out and said we can't let them take the copper, and we need bases in both countries bordering along Zaire. So the Congo and Angola are bordering them, and one of the men that would be sympathetic towards land reforms that could possibly not be used by the CIA, and was described as a victim of the imperialist commandos, was assassinated along the border of Zaire. We think that the Africans are a bunch of Idi Amins killing each other off, that they're nothing but tribal cannibals eating each other because our news is so distorted always, but actually some of these people are very capable of ruling and would rule properly the way that Mr. Allende might have ruled Chile as compared to the military dictatorship if they'd been allowed to live. This wasn't an ordinary person that was murdered of greed or terror between two tribes, but a man who borders on a country that we're ready to invade and who is making land reforms. And then in Beirut, the leftist leader Kamal Jamblat was murdered in March 1976. We have Mr. Bramlett murdered in Las Vegas with the Culinary Union. We have a leader of the same ilk in the Congo murdered, and one in Beirut. All within 3 weeks' time, they were murdered. Mr. Jamblat, again, was a leader with what they call leftist alliances. He happened to be a millionaire landlord. He was not part of a just Muslim-Christian fight. He had ideals identical to the land reforms that Papandreou wanted in Greece before he was thrown out in 1967 by the CIA. And Mr. Kamal Jamblat of Beirut also was espousing land reform programs. He was described as a poet and a mystic. The obituaries and the editorials in the New York Times now come out and say he didn't deserve to die. But when he was living, nobody ever gave a profile of what the man does. They wait and write these beautiful obituaries when they're dead, but they never give you the real truth of what's happening. After he was dead, he's described as a poet, a mystic. His sister was killed a year ago by the Christian forces. Christian, and I imagine the same CIA that's been forcing a lot of these murders upon native populations. He was the head of the Socialist Party. He broke ranks with other millionaires and was a prominent political figure. So it's a terrible tragedy that these people are being killed. I saw Admiral Turner, our new head of the CIA, on television, I believe Meet the Press or Face the Nation, about 2 weeks ago, right after Mr. Kamal Jamblat was murdered in Beirut, and his remark was it obviously was an internal affair. That's the way Ramsey Clark handled the Justice Department's announcement within hours after Martin Luther King was killed. This is the way the Justice Department handled the lone assassin after John Kennedy was killed. Why is it obviously an internal affair when we're funding the very people that are murdering these people and the very people that are being killed, whether it's our labor union leaders in America, whether it's in the Congo, whether it's in Beirut? Why are the same kind of people always being murdered and the same people with the same goals? And how far is this going to go if every leftist leader is murdered and every labor leader is murdered along the line? When are you going to be safe in this country? Who is going to represent your interests as the taxes go into a new war machine in Africa and the wages are controlled but the profits? If you read the back pages of your Wall Street papers or any daily paper, keep going up for the multinationals. Another important murder down in Los Angeles in March 77 was Howie Stindler, who was kidnapped and smothered. Famous fight manager, and it was this same manager who was the model for the role in the movie Rocky, played by Burgess Meredith. He was taken in the back of his gold Cadillac, his 1976 Cadillac, and strangled and killed. And there were important links to the youth organization and the sports events and figures down Los Angeles in the Bobby Hall murder, and two people that were charged with that have never gone to trial yet on that case. They're sleeping on that, people that worked for the Hughes and Summit Corporation. So fight managers, also with important contacts in the Las Vegas area, are not immune from this, and they have interconnecting links to each other, these various murders. And last but not least, there was a witness along my weekly murders, and then we'll go on to George de Morenschild for the remainder of the program. I want to talk about him because he also was missing. If you heard the news this evening, and there's a long account, and George de Morenschild's been missing 4 weeks now. We want to get back to him. But one gentleman who hasn't been murdered but who left the court case, not like Mr. Corbett from the Hughes Air West case, who's been missing a month on that very important case, that Levain Forsyth came down to Las Vegas to testify on how he delivered the will to Melvin Dumar at a gas station in Nevada, the Howard Hughes will. Dumar was taken up to Anchorage, Alaska to see Forsyth and said he didn't recognize them. But the CIA and Noah Dietrich and the powers that be are so determined to push that will, even though it was planted at the office of the president of the Mormon Church the day John Connally was there, with John Connally's notorious links with the CIA and Lockheed and the Hughes Corporation. They're still pushing that. And they brought Levain Forsyth down to Vegas to testify in March about this particular will. And while he was in Vegas overnight, he received a call that, this is the quotation, "Talk about the payments to the Capitol and you are a dead man," end quotes. And Forsyth claims that his son is employed at Hughes Aircraft in Los Angeles and that he could not testify anymore. He went on the stands one day in the Las Vegas court. He took the Fifth Amendment 50 times. He would answer nothing about his connections with the Hughes organizations. He showed a bank deposit slip for $2,800 in $100 bills, which he said was for delivering the will that he was supposed to have delivered. Now, Roden, this is Harold Roden, the attorney, is representing Noah Dietrich, and he claimed that the thread by which the entire state settlement hangs right now on Forsyth. But Forsyth didn't like that responsibility any more than Mr. Trafficante liked testifying about the assassination teams before the new House Select Committee in Washington, D.C. Trafficante saw all his buddies murdered, and he took the Fifth over and over again. So Mr. Forsyth went to Vegas for one day. He walked out on the court. They could have stopped him at the Las Vegas airport, but they let him go back to Anchorage, Alaska. He left without completing his scheduled deposition. Now, you try that sometime. When you're called in court and you say, "I'm not going to testify," take the Fifth Amendment 50 times, say, "I don't want to talk to you, I'm going home," just walk out of the court and leave and go on your trip up to Alaska, see if you get away with it. But Forsyth left without completing his deposition. He left without permission of the court. He left without being stopped at the airport. There were two threats on his life since this all came up, and he said it's involved in the settlement of the will. And Forsyth, as he went back to Alaska and he's had interviews there, said, "They can lock me up. They can throw the keys away. I will never discuss the missions that I carried out for Howard Hughes." So Forsyth, on fear of his life, has left. A labor leader was brutally slain in Las Vegas, Nevada, a year after the Hughes organization swore, according to a court deposition of Mr. Greenspun, that they would kill the culinary union. That labor leader is dead. The missing witness, the Air West trial, Mr. Corbett, is still missing. And now we go to George de Morenschild because he's missing. And the next 20 minutes, I want to talk about him. We could do, as I said last week, I think I could do 10 hours on missing and murdered people in the last 2 months, and that's just a sample. And maybe next Monday we'll go into a few more of them so you get the picture. Because when we read about assassination teams in Argentina that 1,000 or more people are missing, they're missing in America and are being slain in America. And you better catch on that this is happening, and the people who are being slain would represent our interests if they could tell the truth, but they're never going to live to tell the truth. Well, I don't know if you heard the KLRB news at 5 o'clock today. Steve Seaweed read on it, on the news, an account about a Mr. Altman, a Dutchman, who is a close friend of George de Morenschild, and I briefly mentioned about him last week also, that de Morenschild had said to Mr. Altman over in Brussels, "What would you say if I told you I felt responsible for Oswald's acts?" And then de Morenschild began to confess a few things about his relationship with Oswald, but from that point on the man was missing, and he's not in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. He was teaching down there. He fled with his wife. He went over to Europe, and I'm sure that he won't be back in the United States for a long, long time if he's found alive. The news also said that de Morenschild was confined at Parkland Hospital Mental Institution by his wife, Jean de Morenschild, which is very interesting. And maybe I'll give you, I don't have time to do a whole rundown on Jean, but hopefully maybe we can do some of that next week. And de Morenschild left 1 week after Paul Rygotorodsky died in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Paul Rygotorodsky was responsible for the Solidaris. Those are the white Russians that came from the Tsarist regime into the Dallas-Fort Worth area through an intelligence operation to the Greek Orthodox Church, the conduit of the same CIA front that brought the Sirhan family over here from Jordan years later. Paul Rygotorodsky was an important figure in the Kennedy assassination. He was old, like J. Edgar Hoover or Lyndon Johnson. He could have died of old age, but he was terribly important, and he did testify before the Warren Commission, and he did die just on the eve of these stories breaking, and the week after he died, de Morenschild, who was one of the top agents in the area, took a powder. De Morenschild's testimony before the Warren Commission was the longest of any single witness in terms of pages. To give you an example, George Bowie, who maybe was one of the second or third most important witnesses, had 23 pages of testimony. Max Clark had 12 pages of testimony. Lydia Dmytryk had 12 pages. Catherine Ford had 27. These are people in the Dallas-Fort Worth area that knew about Lee and Marina Oswald. De Morenschild had 118, and his wife had 46. So between them, they had 164 pages of testimony where hardly anybody had that much to say. De Morenschild was important because there were three sets operating in the Kennedy assassination, and these same sets operate in all of these assassinations. And I think I ran down some of this before, but I want to make it clear how it works. There are the actual killers, the gunmen who do the firing, who have the motive. They've been fed enough motivation to get Robert Kennedy or John Kennedy or Martin Luther King. They can be racist, they could be Cubans, because the Bay of Pigs operation, Kennedy pulled back from the invasion there. It was the headquarters of organized crime and prostitution and all kinds of narcotics traffic. There is a Secret Service that covers up the assassination, the plans, the motorcade, that cooperates with federal agencies, and then de Morenschild was so terribly important because he created this false Lee Harvey Oswald that didn't exist. He produced the witnesses who would say things about Oswald that had no basis in fact. And then after Oswald was killed and was a selected patsy, these 20 or 30 agents of the Greek Orthodox Church, known as the Solidaris, could give a profile of Lee Harvey Oswald, such as he beat his wife, he couldn't hold a job, he wasn't happy in Russia, and he wasn't happy in the United States, nothing would make him happy, he was unskilled. All of these things were far from the truth, where Oswald was actually very skilled in language. He could be an interpreter at the United Nations. He was skilled enough in radio work to work at the Minsk radio factory for 2 years while speaking the Russian language. He was trained in microdotting at the Jagger's Chili Stovall Photographic Lab. He was trained in radar in the service. He had top security clearance in the service. De Morenschild placed two important roles for Lee Harvey Oswald, three important roles, and this is why he's so terribly important. He introduced him to the Dallas-Fort Worth area. He first arrived to see Marina Oswald with a Colonel Orloff, who also was involved in intelligence operations. They called on Marina Oswald in the fall of 62 while he was at work, and they set up meetings with Marina Oswald alone, with Everett Glover and Marina Oswald at the home of de Morenschild in Dallas. And Marina and Lee were living in Fort Worth at the time. And she was meeting alone with these people and then would meet with other persons of the oil engineering group, the links to the far right wing and the people who wanted to avenge, get rid of the communists. These were white Russians, wealthy in their own country, a noble people related to the Tsar, some possibly direct lines to the Tsar. We can break some of these down by names, but I want to give you a general impression. These people located Lee Harvey Oswald then in the line of the motorcade at the Texas School Book Depository. So de Morenschild got Oswald introduced to the people that were going to smear him, defame him, and fabricate who he was. This information would be used by Louis Neiser, the famous attorney who prosecuted the Rosenbergs, and it would be used in his introduction to the Warren Report to set the pattern of this kooky Oswald, so that none of the hard evidence about Oswald's degrees, his applications, his aptitude test, his writing skills, his language skills would be ignored. It would be published in the 26 volumes, but the Warren Report wouldn't give him credit. De Morenschild introduced Lee Harvey Oswald to the people who were to set this loner profile that then became important to describe Sirhan, James Earl Ray, Arthur Bremer, and even make up stories about Donald DeFries and his Avenging Society and why he would become part of this prison SLA group. He also was important, de Morenschild, because he was the person who introduced Lee Harvey Oswald to Ruth Payne, and Ruth Payne was to take care of Marina while Lee went down New Orleans area. The purpose to go to New Orleans was to be photographed at the trademark, to meet with the anti-Castro Cubans, to meet with people like Guy Bannister, the FBI agents, the CIA agents, and to set up his operation to give a cover of being a Marxist. He made a record with Ed Butler called I'm a Marxist. Ed Butler works for Patrick Frawley. He formerly owned a lot of sugar cane in Cuba, and he's a far right-winger, important Schick Razor. He owns Schick Razor and the ballpoint pens he started. A very wealthy man in California, Patrick Frawley, did hire Ed Butler for military intelligence. Well, Oswald made a record in New Orleans, I'm a Marxist, when he wasn't a Marxist, and he was photographed in front of the International Trademark. Oswald could be told, as part of his patsy, being a patsy, that he was to be allowed to go back to Russia or Cuba, and this would endear him with the people because they'd see that he had these altercations on the street. And so photographs were taken of Lee Harvey Oswald in front of the Trademark with a man, Carlos Bringier, having what was a really phony altercation, a political little scene. Oswald was taken down to the jail, and of course he asked the warden there to call the FBI agent, and they did, and Oswald was released. That wasn't on the newsreels the day that Kennedy was killed, that the FBI agent went to the jail and got Lee Harvey Oswald out. But they could send a double of Lee Harvey Oswald then in Mexico. And this again was on the news tonight, and I've said many times about the Oswald doubles. They used a man's voice that wasn't Lee Harvey Oswald and used Oswald's name to go to the Soviet embassy and go to the Cuban embassy and make a big scene, make himself conspicuous, and say that he wanted to go to Castro and see Castro in Cuba. So when Lee Harvey Oswald acted as a decoy in the Texas School Book Depository building, he could be later placed as a Marxist and be killed. And then George de Morenschild's witnesses could all synchronize and come in with the story that this was the great conspirator and the Marxist. I did an article for Midnight Magazine, which should be out this next week. Look for it in Safeway or grocery stores or magazine stands. It's on Lee Harvey Oswald and the job at the Book Depository and how de Morenschild got him the job through Ruth Payne. Through those introductions, she got him the job, and the motorcade was brought in front of them. I completed the article for Midnight about two days before I heard that de Morenschild was missing, and I called them back in Connecticut to tell them that de Morenschild, who is mentioned in this article, is now missing, among the Jimmy Hoffa missing or the John Roselli missing, and I don't know if he's dead or alive yet, but I had mentioned him in that article, as I did in my first Watergate story. Now, Jean de Morenschild was the only witness that ever testified that she saw a rifle belonging to Lee Harvey Oswald. She is the only one. This is out of 552 witnesses that the Warren Commission had. The story went that an Easter evening just a few years ago, this time of year, Jean de Morenschild and George arrived at the home of Lee Oswald. Late at night, the Oswalds were both asleep. They opened the door, and there were the two de Morenschilds. And they had an Easter rabbit for Lee Harvey Oswald's child, Rachel. And while Lee was talking to George de Morenschild, Marina took Mrs. de Morenschild into a closet in the back room and said, "Do you want to see Lee's rifle?" and showed her a rifle, closed the closet door, and they walked into the living room and went home. And that was the extent of the rifle story, that Lee Harvey Oswald owned a rifle, which is very interesting. When Jean de Morenchild testified, and I will go into her a lot in the future also, how she came to this country from Manchuria and down to Shanghai and to the United States. She said her brother worked for Howard Hughes, and her brother brought her over to the United States. It's very interesting that Jean de Morenchild, whose daughter is married to the vice president of Lockheed Corporation, and she herself was brought to this country by her brother, who works for the Hughes Corporation, and Robert Mayhew for the Hughes Corporation was hiring people mentioned throughout all of this that were involved with plans to kill Fidel Castro, and who also are mentioned in the research to kill John Kennedy. It's interesting that Jean de Morenchild gets away with a story on seeing a rifle and isn't selected as the only known link of the whole Kennedy assassination. I think it's important to call these people, and this is why they are missing. If I had my choice of calling witnesses before the committee in Washington, I would say George and Jean de Morenchild are number one, because if you can't prove that Lee Harvey Oswald touched or saw a rifle since he was in the Marines, then it's hard to prove that he did that ballistic feat in Dallas, Texas on November 22nd, 1963. Nobody else except Jean de Morenchild, as I say, saw a rifle. Oswald came home from the Soviet Union through customs. There was no rifle or ownership or claiming of a rifle. He stayed at his mother's home. In 1962, she never saw him cling, hold, fire, or own a rifle. He moved to an apartment in Fort Worth, Texas in 62 in the fall, and then up to Dallas in 62, up to 63 in the spring of 63. He was never seen at a rifle range except on an evening when the other Lee Harvey Oswald was in Mexico. The dates didn't coincide. One was being very obnoxious at a rifle range and using the name of Lee Harvey Oswald, but it couldn't have been the one that was in Russia because he was down in Mexico. So nobody saw them, even the Solidarists, even the white Russian community, the ones that lied through their teeth, never saw him with a rifle. No one in New Orleans ever saw Lee Harvey Oswald. Out of the 23,000 exhibits or documents or 552 witnesses, nobody ever saw a rifle on a bus with him, in baggage, in Mexico, or when he came back to Ruth Payne's house. And Ruth Payne testified. This is the same woman whose husband has a national security clearance. It works for Mr. Dornberger, the notorious Nazi that was supposed to be hung, according to the British officials at Nuremberg. Michael Payne worked at Bell Aerospace as a designer of helicopters, and it was at their home where Oswald was supposed to have had a rifle, but Ruth Payne testified there was a rifle in a blanket in a garage. When the police came, she steps on the blanket, and the blanket is supposed to be holding its shape all this time. She's never seen Lee shoot it or cling it or practice it, but what's supposed to be wrapped in a blanket holding this elusive rifle is just holding its shape, and the police come and the rifle is slipped out. So she assumes that he took it to the Texas School Book Depository, even though Mr. Frazier, the neighbor across the street, said there's no way he could have carried it. It was not assembled. If it went in, he held a package, a paper bag, under his arm. Nobody saw him put a rifle in a paper bag. The bag fit from his palm to his underarm. This rifle didn't fit that way. He didn't carry it into the depository. Nobody saw him carry it. Nobody saw it assembled. There were other Mausers, according to the testimony, in the depository, but Lee Harvey Oswald didn't have it. He didn't have gloves. Never was there anyone who said he ever used gloves or was seen with gloves or was arrested with gloves or any thrown away in the trash, and yet there wasn't a trace of a fingerprint. So the only link of Lee Harvey Oswald was a photograph taken at a fence on Neely Street, which was a CIA safe house that was used by the Dallas Police Department when Oswald moved out in the spring of 63 and went to New Orleans, and Marina moved with Mrs. Payne. That's when the pictures could be taken of Oswald's head superimposed upon a body against a fence. The de Morenchilds are an interesting couple, and I've done extensive years and years of research fishing out everything about them. And this is why it's so interesting to me that they've disappeared. And as I say, we could do many, many shows on them, and I might do it. George was born in Tsarist Russia. He was 53 at the time of the Kennedy assassination. His father was Sergius Alexander von Morenchild. director of the Nobel oil fields in Russia. He described him as the marshal of mobility of the Minsk province, representative of the landowners to the government of the Tsar. He was an important official in the Tsarist government. Nobel is a large oil concern in Russia that was confiscated and expropriated by the Marxists, the revolution, Lenin, and the new government that came into power. And of course, there was a reason for de Morenschild to want to avenge this and keep the Entente and the Cold War going. I will next week talk to you, I think, at length more about de Morenschild and then James Earl Ray, because they're in the news now. And I'll sign off for now and go back to them and maybe carry a few more missing persons. That's all for now. I'll see you next week on Dialogue Conspiracy.
Is this new? Oh, you want to play that? Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you had the wrong one in there. Oh, my God.